Fannie Mae cracks down.
The mortgage company moves to stop strategic defaults.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Bill Radke. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. The big guarantor of mortgages says we're not going to guarantee your next mortgage for a while if you walk away from the one you've got.
Speaking of walking, or should I say yachting, where in the world is Tony Hayward? And another voyage of note, trolls are back. But first,
the government-owned mortgage company Fannie Mae says if you walk away from your underwater mortgage, even though you could afford to make the payments, they may go after you in court and they may refuse to back another mortgage for you for 7 years. Let's talk about this with economist Diane Swonk of Mesirow Financial. She's with us from Chicago. Hi, Diane.
Good morning.
So Fannie Mae takes on so-called strategic defaults. Why is it doing that?
Well, the important issue is it's looking at what life is going to be like after it grows up, and the government taxpayer is no longer guaranteeing its losses. If it can't guarantee its losses, it's got to be a little more careful about the mortgages it buys. And if you repeat default, that costs Fannie Mae, and right now it's costing taxpayers.
That's been a bit of a contagion.
It's horrible. What we've seen is that if you were someone who can service your mortgage, but your next-door neighbor goes ahead and walks because they think it's easier to walk even though they can pay for it, your chance of defaulting on your mortgage goes up to almost 50%. It's really the whole, all of the, you know, preconceived notions of people paying even when they're underwater have been blown out of the water.
Now, I'm not sure how big a heavyweight Fannie Mae is. They say that, you know, they won't guarantee your mortgage for 7 years. Does that mean I can't get a mortgage for 7 years if I walk away?
Well, basically, they're the only buyers in the market these days. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are the only buyers of mortgage-backed securities. And if they won't take it, the banks won't lend it. So This is a major influence on the market.
So the idea is to help out the housing market. People abandoning their homes drives everything down, sales and prices and construction. But how big a difference will this move really make?
Well, right now it looks like about 12% of all mortgage defaults are these strategic defaults where people could afford to actually pay it, but then they walk away and drive away in the car that they used to buy with the home equity they extracted from their home. That's not a lot, but on the margin it's really important, and we think it's a bigger portion going forward because one quarter of all mortgages in the U.S. economy today are underwater. To prevent some of those people, at least, you know, 10 to 20% from actually leaving their mortgage, that means your home's got a better chance of firming in value rather than falling in value over the next year.
Well, it's a controversial issue. Of course, a lot of people say, hey, it's just a contract, and the big boys, the big lenders, walk away all the time when they want to. But that's another day, Diane Swonk. It's good to get your take on this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Diane Swonk of Mesirow Financial.
All right, for more on this story, we turn now to Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman. Hi, Mitchell.
Good morning, Steve.
How does Fannie Mae plan to cut down on these strategic defaults?
Well, Fannie is going to begin locking out borrowers from getting new home loans that it backs for 7 years. It'll also go after strategic defaulters for the money that they owe in states that allow that. You know, economists point out this can kind of act like a virus that spreads in a neighborhood. All of a sudden, you have a lot of houses in foreclosures. Even if it's not a place where people can't afford their mortgages, let's say because there's been a lot of job loss.
And how much of a problem is this nationwide, Mitchell?
Well, foreclosures, of course, is a huge problem to begin with. Of those, a report by Morgan Stanley recently found that 12% are strategic at this point. And the trend may continue to increase because home prices are still going down. It's a question, though, how much of a problem it is for people who can still pay their mortgages to just walk away because they owe more than that house is worth. Paul Dales is at Capital Economics in Toronto.
If you do a strategic default and you stop paying your mortgage, then that means you actually have more money to spend on other items, thereby boosting the economy. But then that puts a lot more pressure on the banking sector and the companies that lent you that money. So in that sense, it really isn't good for the U.S. economy.
And, you know, there are academics who say it's perfectly rational, economically speaking, to do this as long as you can handle that penalty of the 7-year lockout. Some big real estate developers clearly think it's fine since they've been also walking away from billion-dollar mortgages that they don't want to pay on.
All right. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reporting this morning. Mitchell, thanks.
You're welcome.
The U.S. Supreme Court set aside today a ruling that upheld the conspiracy conviction of former Enron exec Jeffrey Skilling. The high court said prosecutors were mistaken in the way they prosecuted Skilling, but justices left it to a lower appeals court to determine whether his conviction should be overturned. We're going to get some analysis of that ruling this morning from Michael Connor, editor of Business Ethics Magazine. He's with us from New York. Good day to you, sir.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Doing well. This is centered around this honest services fraud law. I mean, without getting into obnoxious legalese, what is that?
Well, it's a law, a part of the U.S. federal code passed in 1988 that makes it a crime to use either the mail or wire services in a scheme, and the language used is, quote, to deprive another of the intangible right of honest services. Now, the problem is that neither the 28-word provision nor the legislative history has shed any light on what the intangible right of honest services means or to whom it is owed. So that's why the court decision today.
And how's the law been used in the past?
Well, it's been used extensively in a large number of white-collar criminal cases, as well as the prosecutions of public officials. And prosecutors love it because it is short, it's vague, and it's capable of seemingly endless elasticity. One lawyer I talked to said it is the most brazen and obvious attempt to criminalize behavior that may be bad, but that would not otherwise be considered criminal. So prosecutors have loved it. Defense lawyers and obviously defendants have hated it.
And so the Supreme Court left it up to the lower courts to determine whether the conviction should be overturned. What's that going to mean for other white-collar cases?
Well, it means a number of things. One is that in cases that are pending, the courts are going to have to look at the underlying charges. In other words, honest services law usually is accompanied by specific charges such as bribery or kickbacks or other more specific instances of misbehavior. There's one case in Chicago, the case of former Governor Blagojevich, which began about a week or so ago, maybe 2 weeks now, in which the prosecutors anticipated this decision and actually revised their charges against the former governor to include more specific charges.
Michael Connor from Business Ethics Magazine, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, June 24th. I'm Steve Chiotakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at marketplace.org. It's a case of old media versus new. Viacom, the TV company, says it's going to appeal a ruling that came down yesterday in its copyright case against Google. In a billion-dollar lawsuit, the TV giant claimed Google, owner of YouTube, is allowing users to upload copyrighted Viacom material. The federal judge said because Google's removing copyrighted material as soon as it becomes aware of it, it is following the law. So we're going to get some analysis on that ruling. Cecilia Kang is a technology reporter for The Washington Post. She's with us live from D.C. Good morning.
Good morning.
What is Google doing right in terms of the content that may infringe upon these copyright laws?
Well, what Google is doing right is when it is informed by the content creator, that includes Viacom, includes NBC, includes all the companies that create videos and other content on the web, when those companies inform Google through its YouTube site that it has illegal or infringing copyrighted material on its site, it's taking it down. And that was the key to the ruling yesterday. It was that when Google knows that it has infringing content, it takes it down.
So it's about knowledge, right?
It is about knowledge.
Mm-hmm. And specific knowledge about whether this is copyrighted material. As it stands, what does the ruling mean for other video sites?
Well, it's a huge win for a lot of video sites and a lot of applications and sites on the web like Facebook, eBay, because their whole business really is exchanging information. And a lot of the information that's exchanged is copyright protected. So it's a huge win for them because they're no longer responsible or liable for the content that's on their site as long as they do what Google did in this case, which was to take down the material, even though there were tens of thousands of Viacom videos from the Comedy Central, from MTV on YouTube. Google said, we took down the material as soon as we found out that was the case. And was really the key.
Do you think the ruling will be overturned very quickly?
In a way, this is going to set a precedent. I think this case is going to be referred to down the road for other suits. And the the bus has sort of left the station now that this ruling has come down. Viacom is appealing, like you said, but it's going to be there will be more legal battle. But this really was a precedent-setting case, and everybody's going to refer to this going forward.
Cecilia Kang from the Washington Post. Cecilia, thanks.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Bill Radke. Today, the U.S. Senate takes a closer look at for-profit colleges and universities. Many of them get more than 90% of their funding from the government. Marketplace's Eve Tro reports lawmakers are questioning whether students are getting a good return on that investment.
Enrollment at for-profit colleges has more than tripled in the past decade. A lot of that growth has been funded by taxpayers. Iowa Senator Tom Harkin says the government puts $20 billion a year in the industry by way of Pell Grants and federal student loans.
Are students being served well? Are they getting good value for a taxpayer's dollar?
Harkin says the Senate will hear from students who took out lots of loans and either didn't get degrees or failed to land the types of jobs needed to pay back the money. Now they're defaulting on their debt.
The government is garnishing their wages.
The default rate has nothing to do with the type of ownership structure of a school.
Harris Miller is president of the Career College Association, which represents for-profit schools.
It has to do with the demographics of the student population.
He says for-profit schools serve many low-income and minority students. He says as the government aims to expand higher education to those communities, it's going to have to take on more financial risk. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
A crucial vote in Chicago's city council, scheduled for today, could lead to dozens of new Walmart stores to be built in the city. The issue has become an old-fashioned showdown between the retailer, unions, and Chicago politicians. Chicago Public Radio's Tony Arnold has the story.
Walmart wants to build dozens of stores in Chicago, but first it needs city council approval for one store to be located on the city's far south side, and that's been a challenge. For years, the city council's delayed voting on that store, mostly because of the battle between unions and Walmart over the issue of wages. This week, local officials said Walmart will pay Chicago employees a starting wage of $8.75 an hour, 50 cents more than the state minimum wage. Chicago Mayor Richard Daley's on board with the plan. He says Walmart's been unfairly persecuted in the city.
If it's built in a suburb, there's not one controversy. Not one controversy dealing with that development.
As a result of all the media attention, Walmart says it plans to build markets in parts of the city where there are no grocery stores. Despite Walmart's promises, the unions aren't backing down. They want the starting wage to be $11.03 an hour. Dennis Gannon's with the Chicago Federation of Labor.
People need to know that the cost of living is different in urban areas versus rural areas. And if it doesn't get addressed here in the city of Chicago, it won't get addressed anywhere throughout the country.
The unions hold a lot of clout among many city council members. 4 years ago, the unions helped defeat many of the mayor's allies in the city council because they weren't on board with the plan to keep Walmart out. In Chicago, I'm Tony Arnold from Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, June 24th. I'm Bill Radke. We're going to get a take on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects the United States. The Federal Reserve had some discouraging words about the recovery yesterday. The Fed said, quote, financial conditions have become less supportive of economic growth. The statement did not specifically name European debt as the problem. It just referred to developments abroad. Jan Randolph follows sovereign debt at IHS Global Insight in London.
We know that the U.S. is the largest economy in the world, but the European Union taken together is about equivalent size, roughly $14 trillion worth of GDP. So a very important consumption block part of the global economy. And if Europe has problems, that's likely to have an impact elsewhere.
The Fed's words have not exactly been a tonic for traders. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org.
British oil giant BP seems to be containing the oil gusher again after a collision of some of its equipment a mile under the surface of the Gulf of Mexico. For a time yesterday, oil was spewing at previously high levels until a fix was made. A complete fix, of course, would help give company CEO Tony Hayward his life back. But for now, he's out of the spotlight. The beleaguered exec is no longer running the British oil giant's cleanup operations. From London, Stephen Beard has more.
Once he was everywhere, on the Gulf Coast, on Capitol Hill, on the nightly TV news. Then suddenly, Tony Hayward disappeared. He failed to show up at a major oil industry gathering in London. Another public appearance was also cancelled. Now we know why. Hayward has been replaced, not as chief executive, but as BP's boss in the Gulf. That job has now gone to an American BP executive who comes from Mississippi. This just may help the company's shattered reputation, says oil analyst Nick McGregor.
There'll be a greater degree of empathy when people see somebody who is from one of the Gulf states standing there and saying BP cares about what's happening here.
But still, the question remains, where is Tony Hayward? BP's press office says they never comment on the chief executive's whereabouts. But one commentator here reckons that Hayward is enjoying his lower profile and sailing his yacht on the unpolluted waters off the southern coast of England. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
We all know the symbol for the U.S. dollar. England's pound sterling has a cursive letter L with a line through the middle. In fact, lots of world currencies have a symbol, but not Indian rupees. They're traditionally represented by the English letters R and S. Until today, India's government has unveiled a new symbol for the rupee, and that's led Marketplace's Rico Galliano to wonder, does anyone really care?
Well, Indians care. A lot. That's according to Gunjan Bagla. He's a director at Amrit Inc., helping U.S. companies do business in India.
There is a desire among the Indian public as well as the Indian government to assert their position in the world. This is a symbol that will get reflected in usage by financial publications worldwide. You know, it may make its way onto computer keyboards eventually.
India is not the only emerging economy to try this. In fact, Douglas Mudd of the Money Museum in Colorado says India may have been spurred on by Russia, which has been trying to popularize a ruble symbol for the last 3 years. Mudd says the design of these symbols can be the subject of fierce national debate.
Where previously they were just symbols and they were important only in that they represented a currency. Now the symbols have become a source of pride in some way, or at least a source of nationalist focus.
India avoided some controversy by holding a design contest. The new rupee logo wasn't invented by politicians. It was selected from thousands submitted by Indian citizens. I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Steve Chiatakis. There's a new boat trip that explores commerce instead of just the coastline. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Caitlin Carroll takes us on a ride on the first urban ocean cruise.
On a sunny afternoon in Long Beach, California, dozens of tourists and locals board a small passenger boat. It's moored outside of an aquarium.
This is the Caroline, and we're getting ready to go on the very first urban ocean cruise.
Jerry Schubel is director of the Aquarium of the Pacific in Long Beach. It's about a half hour south of Los Angeles. Schubel started the Urban Ocean Cruise to educate passengers about this piece of very productive but also very fragile coastline.
We will be going into the inner parts of the nation's two largest ports. So we will take them places that they probably would not notice on their own.
The cruise covers the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, which handle almost 40% of all U.S. cargo traffic. Passengers pay $30 for a view of rusty cranes, massive container ships, and hulking power plants. High school senior Natalie DeLosa is unimpressed. She thinks the ports are kind of a gross place to visit.
You know how Paris has like the tours of the sewers? I think it's a lot like that.
The urban boat cruise does mention sewage and other environmental concerns. The aquarium talked to fishermen, longshoremen, shipping companies, and even surfers to understand how people and wildlife interact with this busy harbor. The tour highlights ways the ports try to cut down on pollution, and passengers also hear how they can keep sea life swimming in cleaner waters.
Any trash, chemicals, fertilizers, pesticides that end up in our streets get washed down storm drains and carried out right here where the LA River meets the Pacific Ocean.
But for some passengers, the Urban Ocean Cruise is just one big boat ride. William Baresh is 7 years old.
You get to go under a drawbridge, see trains, see sea lions playing with seagulls. It was a very fun cruise.
Shubal needs at least 50 passengers every cruise to make the harbor tour viable long term. He'll wait until Labor Day to decide whether to change course or to continue full steam ahead. In Long Beach, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
And finally, you remember those good luck trolls, the homely little dolls with the wild hairdos?
The hair sticking up. Yeah. I do. I had those as a child. I wish I had hung on to them because they might be about to appreciate in value.
Well, DreamWorks Animation says it's turning those dolls into a movie franchise.
Yes, Troll is the new Shrek. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.